Right now, it is time for the Media Beat with David Tarachuk. David, of course, joins us on a Friday morning when either I'm not going to the hospital for a test, or when David's not in the air flying, or when the radio station has problems. So it's been a little while, but we say, nice to have you back on air, David.
Well, hello. I'm glad to be joining the ever-incisive Marshall Miles from my regular base again, finally, the media capital of the world, New York City, after my long overseas assignment and your various medical appointments. You know, we've often said, you and I, that it's good for a journalist to have a periodic total shift of perspective, and I got that by being in Europe. We can get to the news of the week in a moment, Marshall, but would you, if you don't mind, I'd like to just voice a reflection on that recent reporting of mine on Europe, mainly from my main perch over there in Ireland. There's a familiar bit of Anglo-American prejudice, I guess, about the Irish, usually in joke form. We all know the jokes. Suggests the Irish are somewhat unsteady, maybe, even perhaps hot-headed. But I'd like to make a factual reporting point. Now it's over. We can see 2022 as a reporter's year, at least, was largely characterized in the U.S. as intense and angry polarization. 2023 maybe as well. And in the U.K., England especially, as political chaos all year, desperate infighting within the government. Successive governments, indeed. I mean, three governments in 1 year. And now that country is fraught with widespread industrial conflict, bitter labor strikes. But in Ireland, what prevailed? An extraordinary kind of politeness, almost literally. And after you kind of politeness. I mean, that may be a flippant way to describe it, but I'm talking about an actual transfer of power. A new prime minister took office there as the year ended. The top position is called, in Irish, the Taoiseach, the prime minister. And that was the result of an agreement of the country's two major parties to quite literally take turns in filling the role of the nation's leader. Coalition was formed after the last somewhat indecisive general election in 2020. A coalition between the two parties, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, the country's major parties that owe their existence to the bloody Irish Civil War early in the last century, plus a junior partner in the coalition, the Irish Green Party, as in environmentally green, that is, not Irish Green, Irish Nationalist Green. The two main competing leaders agreed that one, Micheál Martin, would go first, holding office for 2 years, which ran out in December 22. And the other, Leo Varadkar, who'd been Taoiseach once before, would step again into office as he did just a little before the end of the year, and is now settling in for his turn at governing for the next 2 years. All very gentlemanly, don't you think?
Yes.
Quite amazing.
You know,
and maybe I should just add this too, just to emphasize Ireland's distinctiveness. I mean, you know, and it's not innate to coalition government governing. That's my point, I suppose. Let me draw a contrast with another country that frequently engages in coalition government, Israel, where, yes, he's back, Benjamin Netanyahu, BB to his friends and enemies. But his newly minted coalition is distinguished by containing, because he needs them, the most right-wing extremist ever in Israeli history, including a man he's appointed to Minister of National Security, Itamar Ben-Gvir, a man who's been convicted of racist crimes and been seen brandishing a gun at Arab communities. Tax fraud, too, is another blotter against Bibi's coalition members. But then why should that surprise us? The new prime minister himself is still undergoing legal proceedings on corruption charges. And as we begin 2023 now, we don't know how that discomforting example of leadership is going to work out. So all in all, I really did see myself in Dublin as sitting in an island of relative sanity and decency. And then I arrived back here. and to what? One of my newly elected members of my own state, New York's delegation to the U.S. Congress, has been caught out lying about his history. George Santos, of course, with astonishingly ludicrous claims about his finances, his ancestry, his credentials, his so-called Wall Street career, and who knows what else as well. And the message as often is that it was the press who found him out. Local papers journalists on Long Island's North Shore Leader, a very small paper. Journalists doing just what they should be doing, that is holding our public representatives accountable. But interestingly, the story failed to get any traction with the national press until the New York Times, rather belatedly, did pick it up. And then just about everybody now is shrieking for his resignation or dismissal. Almost everyone. More about that in a moment. The man Santos himself is refusing to budge. The everyone who wants him out of office includes local and regional state leaders of his own party, the Republicans. Those who don't want him out are that same party's leadership at national level, not least our new, barely elected himself, Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy, who's been feeding reporters the old weasel words. Let me quote him directly. The voters of his district have elected him. He's seated. He is part of the Republican conference. And in my assessment of the speaker's words, I'm aware I'm being unfair to weasels. So, yeah, I've come back to a wild and wacky American scene. I guess that does mean that as journalists we have a lot more to consider and a lot more to talk about on Friday morning with the media beat.
You know, the Santos story is even, it's even deeper than what the man lies about everything. I mean, everything. And I think, yes, they don't want to turn their 5-seat majority in the House to 4 because they know that it's a Democratic, it's a very competitive district. And the Republican Party wants him out locally. He's not going anywhere, but he will go sooner or later. Those theft charges of stealing checks are going to come back to haunt him when he's convicted of that, because that's something that they can bring up ethics with. The other things, I don't know what's going to happen.
Sure, electoral law is pretty severe on that matter. We don't want to prejudge a legal proceedings, but I suspect it really is just a matter of time before, yes, he goes.
It's an amazing story of how politics is so tainted in just about every form. And then, you know, you look at the Democratic Party. They just, you know, they just can't seem to cut a break with Joe Biden when he was vice president. He had some documents, and those documents were left in one office and then left in another office. The difference is that the Democrats found them and turned them over. But once again, it's just more mayhem in Washington, and it's, you just can't explain it. You couldn't write a movie with this in it, David.
It has that flavor of a wacky Hollywood movie for sure, and it's a tit for tat fight, of course, now about those two cases of White House documents turning up where they shouldn't be. The comparison, though, as all self-respecting media outlets are pointing out, is far less tit for tat, more apples versus oranges. If you try and compare Joe Biden's people mislaying his papers from the vice presidency, turning up at his home's garage and his out of government think tank office, and his lawyers then reporting the find to the National Archives, and on the other hand, Donald Trump doing all that he could to fight the National Archives over those papers. He was fighting the FBI as well, of course, and the Justice Department, for that matter, over those hundreds of files spirited away to Mar-a-Lago. But the great differences between the two cases are not going to prevent outlets like Fox News, for instance, just to name one newsroom that's salivating over the story, from yelling about double standards in the Biden administration. And we'll see that. And you know, you can see that journalists now have a job, along with the special counsel, of course, Robert Hur, getting to the bottom of the Biden papers story. So we will know eventually if you know, any of the shrieking is justified. What's clear is that the Biden administration did try its best to, well, we don't know if it's absolutely its best, but they did decide to promptly cooperate with the National Archives and also with their own Justice Department. And that paints a very different picture from the way that Trump reacted. So with such hostility and you know, an effort to turn it into a battle, which is, I guess is just, you know, par for the course with the Trump camp. So we'll see how much those comparisons end up being at all justified. But at the moment, they look strikingly different.
Absolutely. And you know, I saw yesterday, and I even heard locally from some Democrats criticizing Merrick Garland for acting so quickly. Quite to the contrary, I think as an attorney general, after what we saw in the last administration, he did the exact right thing. Let's bring in an independent person. Let's begin to answer the questions before anything else. I think it was a very good and swift move by Merrick Garland.
Yeah, if you have any interest at all in the truth, which I guess journalists are supposed to have, then the conclusion is that the Attorney General didn't have much choice. He just have to do that, have to set up a special investigation and you know, be seen to be even-handed in application of what he sees as the legal position.
Absolutely, and I guess seeing as you travel so much, I have to bring this up. And what happened with the FFA over the, actually from Christmas time on, which we just found out about the other day, when the FAA had to stop all flights that were about to take off for about 90 minutes, and that was corrupted files that were in their computers not once but twice, at both times, once in the mainframe and the other one in the backup, shows exactly how liable computer technology is. And also, this system that the FAA uses is nearly 50 years old. And the main thing that I heard out of this is that Congress just doesn't want to spend the money to bring it up, you know, over the years to keep improving it. I mean, this is, once again, something that I just find totally unbelievable.
Sure. I mean, on a personal note, an entirely selfish note, I was really grateful that I had just finished my trip when this terrible set of outages happened and the FAA found itself grounding everybody. For, of course, formally 90 minutes, but of course the knock-on effect of that was enormous, and you know, every single airport in the United States affected by it, and all the ripple effect of that worldwide. And yes, the aged technology is a crying scandal. And as you say, the reluctance of Congress to loosen its purse strings when it comes to modernizing public infrastructure is well known. We have an interesting and welcome exception to that with the recent commitment to, you know, enormous amounts of public spending on essentially land-based national infrastructure. You know, it's every bit as important, but in some ways perhaps more important, you know, as we move forward, to have the best and most up-to-date technology with air travel, too. I mean, it's ridiculous that we're flying 30,000 feet up, reliant on technology that is several generations old. I'm not sure I'm looking forward to my next flight wherever it might be. This is very disturbing. And here's a case for bold political action by those who do control the purse strings. But what we are not going to see, I'm going to make one prediction for this newly starting year, one prediction about the U.S. Congress, is that we'll not be taking any bold moves.
The bold moves they'll take, we've already seen a look at what a difference between, and once again, how elections make a difference, between the way the Congress was run under Nancy Pelosi and what the way it's being run under McCarthy. What's interesting about this is that, and the thing that scares me the most, I mean, I don't mind, part of their new rules was to give more time for legislators to look at bills, not have them rush so quickly. That's a great idea. But when you can have one person in the United States Congress call for the House Speaker to leave, and then the ensuing time that they will waste in finding a new Speaker of the House, that has the potential to tie things up in ways that we never, ever imagined before.
Yeah, and it's interesting that on that particular kind of radicalism, it is an extraordinary piece of, just a sort of extremity of thinking to say that out of the hundreds of members of the House of Representatives, one single congressperson can move to express no confidence in the Speaker and then precipitate a new election. That kind of extremity is the kind, I mean, ironically enough, is the kind of extreme sort of condition under which the House has to work now, that Republicans were accusing the squad on the far left of the Democrats Party of favoring, that the kind of return of power to the rank and file membership of the House, which the left wanted, is now being enacted, ironically enough, by the gang of 20, if you like, who held Kevin McCarthy hostage while he was getting elected, and he made all these concessions. It's an old classic balance that needs to be struck all the time in the Democratic bodies between between complete democracy and stability and efficiency. One person upsetting the deliberations and holding up the legislative process of a deliberative body like the U.S. Congress, the House in particular, is an important balance to strike. It's decidedly imbalanced if one person can hold the entire chamber hostage in a way that, as you say, would hold up business in a really serious and destructive manner.
And we got an example of it when 15 or 16 votes, so a week and a half went by, where Congress did nothing but try to elect a new Speaker of the House, and that was just that issue. Never mind the issues that are going to come up. Those 20 legislators that are sticking together. I'm all for people to have their views and want to push those views, but when you become a politician, there has to be a time where your views you can push for and you can try to get it enacted, but you can't totally discount someone else, even if they're in your party, you can't totally throw out the mediation process, which is what politics is all about. And that's the dangerous thing that sits before us for the next 2 years, is that mediation between not only Democrats and Republicans, but Republicans and Republicans, is absolutely just thrown out the window.
Yeah, there's a familiar phrase used in Congress, a little bit too loosely for my taste, but people talk about the nuclear option. And in this case, the nuclear option is that power of one individual member to shut the whole thing down. That kind of ultimate power is just totally counterproductive for doing what the people who have run for this office for a seat in this National Assembly say when they're campaigning that they want to serve the people, and in fact it's guaranteed to mean instability and delay and often much more gridlock than we've had even until now, I'm frankly not looking forward to this particular Congress. It's going to be a sticky and hot and fervid turmoil, I think, for the next two years.
You know, and you look at the Democratic Party, there's turmoil there, but you have progressives and you have liberals and you have conservative Democrats. And Bernie Sanders, as a progressive, his thing is it's the old fashioned political way of doing it. You go in looking for a full loaf, and you try to get a half loaf. But if you don't get a half loaf, you get a quarter loaf. The Democrats, who normally eat themselves, can manage to do that in their party, and you hope that the majority of people can convince these 20 to kind of step back a little bit. And not use that nuclear option on every single issue.
Well, we'll see how it goes. But as I say, my instinct, is that what it is? No, my experience, and all our experiences, I'm sure, will be conditioning what we think about the future. But it's hard not to see it as a Congress in which little will get done, at the very least, and what does get done will all be by nature of a of a pre-electoral fight for the 24 presidential race in mind, more than anything else. It's all about who gets to hold on to power and who gets to grab power again next time. I'm not being naive when I say that, that would seem to be the case all the time. But I think the cards are stacked so much now against constructive governing and for just a kind of political Donnybrook between now and 2024. I can't be optimistic about it at all.
Well, when Steve Bannon, all this years ago, when Donald Trump started to run, he wanted to burn the system down, and that's what these people want to do. They don't want to negotiate. They don't want that. They want to tear the system down, and yet they don't have anything that can replace it, David.
Well, yes, it'd be interesting to know what. A good political interview to be conducted at the moment is quite simply to put Kevin McCarthy in a corner and just badger him endlessly. What do you want to see happen? What new legislation do you want to see? What new things do you want for the American people? And how are you going to provide them? That's an interview I'd like to see sometime.
All right, David. We'll speak to you next week. Thank you very much and welcome back.
Thank you very much. Look forward to next week, too.
David Tarachuk with the Media Beat here on The Breakfast Club on Robinhood Radio.